Welcome to the Time Bubble Podcast, the only podcast where the guests get to travel in time. This week, I am joined by the host of the Not the BBC podcast, Seb Abekasis. Welcome, Seb. Did I pronounce your name right? I had to practice.
You did. That was a big moment there, and you've cleared the hurdle. So well done. Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's great to be here.
That's great. Thanks for coming on. So before we start, tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Yeah, so I blog and I put interviews up on YouTube. And the idea is I want to curate sort of as intelligent a high level perspective on what's going on kind of politically, but sort of more broadly with society and the culture. So I refer to a lot of kind of old political theorists. I go through their work. And I also sort of look at who the most interesting analysts are out there today, where they're talking about markets, geopolitics, some more kind of abstract stuff around sort of like sense making. And yeah, I try and present it in a sort of clear and cogent way for people to understand. So I sort of try and synthesize the best of what's being said about the current state of affairs. And I sometimes share my own thoughts too.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot that needs making sense of lately. I mean, I don't know how you feel. I guess I'm a little bit older than you. I've been on the planet 50 plus years, and it seems that probably more has happened in the last, say, 5 or 6 years than in probably the 2 or 3 decades prior to that.
Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, I think we sometimes, when things happen and they kind of pick up a head of steam in the way that they have, you notice the dynamics more, you notice the way technology has sort of shaped certain parts of our life. But in some ways also, when you look back at it, you also kind of appreciate the foundations for where we are today kind of have been in place for a few decades, but it definitely seems that we've reached a sort of runoff point where things are all accelerating, which is quite bewildering, really.
It is. The snowball is running down the hill faster and faster. So
yeah, exactly.
It will be interesting to see where it all goes, but we shall see. Okay, great. So I'll put some links in for that at the end of the show in case anyone wants to look it up. But for now, we'll move on with the time bubble. So I believe you've heard some episodes before, so where we're going with
this. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, great. Thank you. Well, today you get the chance to talk about 3 past days of your life to begin with and what you'd like to do if you could revisit them. So without further ado, tell us about the first day you'd like to go back to.
First day. Okay. So I can't remember the exact date, but it's probably sometime in June 2010. Which was when I finished secondary school. So I had quite an interesting experience for secondary school. I went to Eton College, having come from Gibraltar. My father's from Gibraltar. I grew up in the south of Spain. I went to an international school. My father's from a pretty ordinary family in Gibraltar, and sort of met my mum at university in England. And they're from pretty different backgrounds, but I was kind of fortunate enough to be able to be sent to school in England, and I had no idea about what Eton College even was before I went there, so it was all quite an interesting experience being there, and never sort of felt fully at home, and so was sort of kind of always kind of in my own world there. I met some good people, made some decent friends, but broadly it was something that I never really kind of found my place in. So when we come to the end of it, this time in June, towards the end of it, I remember because I was sort of flying back to Spain at the end of term, I'd done my exams and most people had left the school. So the school was completely empty. So I just remember just going on a wander around, and it's quite a, you know, big school with all the, you know, vast grounds, and you have, you know, you can go into, you know, it's by Windsor and whatnot. So, you know, you can walk around for quite a considerable period of time. So I remember just sort of wandering around there and just sort of contemplating my place in the world. Some parts of me were sort of in a state of regret that I didn't kind of make more out of going there. In terms of like academically, I didn't do particularly well, and as it transpired after, I was perfectly capable of competing intellectually with the sorts of people there, But, you know, I was sort of bottom of the classes academically, never really achieved much in sports. I kind of grew quite late, never kind of felt fully part of it there socially either. So sort of kind of, yeah, I just remember being in this deep state of contemplation. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but when it's sort of one of the first memories I can remember going back, kind of looking back, where I was sort of in touch with who I am now. So if I look back at my teens or my childhood, they're much more of like a dream. But I can sort of run a thread of consciousness sort of starting from then. Then I have a couple of other kind of big memories, you know, the ensuing years after that. And so, yeah, sort of in many ways, perhaps it's when my adult life, my mature life started. And I don't know why I remembered it. I just, when, you know, when I sort of agreed to come on this podcast and I was just thinking back, it's just one of those days that popped up. And again, I feel like your character and your sense of who you are develop over many years, but you also have these sort of few critical points, these few critical days that you remember where you were sort of deeply pensive and where you really started to shape an identity. And I think in many ways this was one of the first ones for me, so that's why I thought I'd like to revisit it.
Yeah, there's a lot that springs to mind there. You went to probably the most famous school in Britain to begin with, but I understand your feeling of not quite belonging there, because I also went to a private school on not as prestigious as Eton, but I went to Magdalen College School in Oxford. And we did discuss on an earlier episode, I had another fellow pupil on with me, and we both went there as local kids. They had to take on, as well as all the, you know, the academically or the well-heeled, a number of sort of local kids are on assisted places from the local primary schools. And it was a very different environment from the school I'd previously been at, and from anything else I'd ever known. Very regimented. And from the time I was there, I certainly felt that same feeling of not quite belonging. And certainly in, you know, looking back years later, I can see that I didn't. And you're right. It's the day you leave is a watershed moment.
Yeah.
And I remember mine as well. We had a school hymn called The Lilies, which was only ever sung on the final day of the school year. And I remember the year I left, which would have been in the mid to late 80s. And despite the fact that I was so happy to be getting out of there, because it just wasn't where I want to be, I can remember feeling quite, it was probably the first time I had a feeling of nostalgia. At the age of 17, singing that hymn and feeling quite sad that I would never be stood in this chapel where I'd had to do, you know, morning prayers and everything every day for sort of 6-7 years. And there was this, oh wow, what's going to happen next?
Pat, it's interesting. I that notion of nostalgia as well, I think that makes sense that I was feeling that as well. And perhaps you're at that sort of age, 17, 18, you've never really felt anything quite approximating nostalgia before. So perhaps that's why it's sort of striking.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, your situation before, but in terms of where I came from before, I'd been a very close knit group of friends at a international school in Spain. I'd been at the same school in a very little bubble from when I was sort of 4 till, you know, till I was about 13. Right. And so, sort of going from this state where you're not really as aware of yourself because you're just sort of part of the furniture almost, to going, you know, you sort of taken out of that and you go and you're in a completely opposite position where you're utterly self-aware because you everything's brand new. The kinds of people are acting and talking in a body alien ways. And so perhaps it's a sort of dissonance between those two that really like registers, imprints itself on you. But yeah, definitely then you're sort of, as you come to leave this, you know, you've had this secondary school experience, which you have sort of mixed emotions about. It's sort of like a rebirth almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, stepping outside from there, and I think with Eton and my school that is probably different to the state schools is they're almost their own little worlds. It's like a little cocoon of traditional things that have, you know, like with everything from, you know, the teachers with the mortar boards and the annual rugby match between the masters and the boys and the chapel. And, you know, it's like when you step into those schools, you go into a self-contained environment.
Yeah,
and it may teach you very well academically and you may get the best quality of teaching, but I do not feel that it prepared me for real life in any shape or form.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you're sort of stepping into a sort of fictional world, aren't you?
Almost. Yeah,
it's fully self-contained. It's its own ecosystem.
I'm thinking of Hogwarts. I'm not a Harry Potter fan, but it's that sort of thing, isn't it?
It's not that far off that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So, do you have a second day you want to talk about?
Yeah, I do have a second day, and this is probably about 4 years later. And it was just after I graduated university, and it's actually probably sometime in June, and it's essentially the day before my grandfather died. So I was, I got to know my grandparents pretty well, my English grandparents, my mother's parents, because when I would come over to school in England, I would stay at theirs at weekends. They would pick me up from the airport and whatnot. And they also used to come out and visit us in Spain quite a lot. So I was lucky to have a close relationship with them. And so I knew my grandpa well, but he wasn't particularly well, but he was one of those people that you couldn't really tell. He was a sort of proud, quite dominant kind of personality. Yeah. And so, you know, he essentially died of heart failure the day after, you know, I was with him the morning. We went to the hairdressers before. Didn't realize anything was up, and then a couple of hours later got a call from my grandmother saying he's just, you know, your grandfather's dead. So it was quite sudden, and so I never really had the chance to speak to him in a deeper way about his life. He was, you know, you always think that it's something that I was aware of a risk of not doing, but you know, you're quite comfortable, you get to know them well, but you're always kind of, you know, you're sort of waiting for this perfect chance to present itself where you're just going to happen to be sitting in front of a fireplace with a bottle of whiskey and just you and your grandfather, and it's just going to roll into a deep conversation where you're going to, you know, you're going to get all of his life's wisdom. You know, things don't really work like that, so there's never a perfect time. So I never got the chance to do that. And you know, he was a really great man. He was one of those people who left a mark on everyone that he met. Very charming, very successful, and just, yeah, a real sort of leader, a very sort of inspiring person. And so I never had the chance to sort of delve into that and sort of understand a bit more who he was at a deeper level, and perhaps, you know, pluck some of his wisdom. A lot of his wisdom was inferred, like pressuring me to get out of bed in the morning, sort of lurking outside my door when I was a teen. And it was a lot of it was leading by example, but I would have liked to definitely sort of delve into his mind a bit more and learn more about him. Yeah,
it's often the case that the opportunity is gone by the time that we want to do it. Now, I think I was quite fortunate in that respect, because I grew up in the 1970s and my grandparents were born sort of at the turn of the century. And there was a lot of time to talk to them when I was younger, because we all lived in quite a tight knit village then. Mm. It's not quite like now where people are scattered around all over the place. So certainly when I was sort of 4 or 5 years old, I would be packed off to the grandparents for the day while parents worked. And I remember having many conversations with them about the war and such like, which I do think was very valuable. And it's probably even more valuable now than it is perhaps ongoing, because the world we have now, we're all leaving digital footprints and information everywhere with blogs and podcasts, etc. But go back two or three generations and there's no real way, unless you write it down, of recording things about your life. Now, they were very happy to sit and talk for hours and hours because they were retired, and we didn't share a bottle of whiskey because I was only about five. But I will say that my early experiences with alcohol, my gran did keep a bottle of sherry in the sideboard.
Okay.
So everybody kept their booze in a sideboard then. I don't think that happens now, but and she would let me have a drop of it, which was quite nice. Yeah. And also those chocolate liqueurs that you get at Christmas, you know, the ones with they look like miniature bottles of Southern Comfort or whatever, and they've got the alcohol and the sugar inside.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, but it's interesting. I keep telling my mum passed on, but my dad, he's in his 80s. But I feel I don't know or didn't know as much about my mother and father's life as I did about my grandparents, possibly because they were busy when I was growing up, that sort of thing. And I keep saying to my dad, look, you should write all this down. Or write your autobiography. Everybody should write their autobiography and pass it on because...
Yeah, it's so valuable.
Yeah. There's just so much that older generation knew and that they taught me.
In terms of your experience speaking to your grandparents, so one of the things about that generation, or I suppose around probably about any English or British generation before perhaps the... you know, who grew up earlier than the 60s is, you know, the sort of stiff upper lip, not willing to sort of share too much about their, at least sort of their internal dialogue, you know, it's sort of all, you know, it's quite not super sort of reflective in that sense. I mean, at least that's been my experience when I think about my grandmother. Did you, you know, was it more them telling you stories, or were they also kind of happy to give you a little insight into who they were and their sort of personal journey, right? The ups and downs they had.
Yeah, they were. And I think it wasn't so much the stiff upper lip. I just think that people talked more because they didn't sit. I mean, they were born, my grandfather was born in 1898 on my father's side, and his wife a couple of years after that. They didn't spend half their lives sitting around just watching television. You know, it sounds like a cliche, people all sitting around the fire in the evening telling stories. But what else did you do in the
1920s? You naturally would have done it more.
And some of the stuff my gran told me was fascinating. Because one of the things we forget is that everybody had feelings and emotions and thoughts just like ours. And for example, my gran showed me this box of letters once that a friend of hers had written to her. And it was during the war. When this guy was having an affair with the butcher's wife in the village, and he was all obsessed with her, and he was asking my gran for advice and help, and these letters are just so detailed, and you could imagine this whole society went, and there was, you know, men away at the war, and there were things going on back in the village, and it's easy to forget. Well, you know, when we talk about history and the war, you know, somebody makes a documentary about the war, it'll be about, you know, the battles and the planes flying over and the Blitz. Nobody ever talks about what people were actually thinking and talking about, do they?
So, no, not at all. And that's, it's never been, well, perhaps, I'm misdiagnosing it, but it seems to me never been compared to people of other nationalities. You know, the Americans and whatnot, you know, they love to talk more about, you know, I was a young buck back in the day and stuff like that. So anytime that we've had the chance to do that, you know, anyone British has done that has done pretty well, I'd say, if they've had those sorts of experiences.
I just think that we should value not just our grandparents, the older folk in society. You know, I think too many people just dismiss them as old people, and they've got a whole lifetime of tales to tell if you're willing to take the time to listen.
Definitely
brilliant. Okay, so let's move on to day number three.
So day number three is probably 2 years after that. I would say it's around September 2016, or maybe about September 2017. But basically, in terms of where it is chronologically in my life, I guess it's the first time that things came together for me. And so I mentioned not making the most of secondary school. By the time I got to university, my plan was very much scraper 2-1 and have as much fun as possible. So I did that. So kind of wasted the university years. You know, it, once again, you know, met some good people, made some great friends and whatnot. But in terms of like actually doing anything worthwhile with my life, you know, I couldn't have made less of it. So around, you know, after I've left university, I then switch goes off and I start getting pretty motivated and try and really whip myself into shape. And after that, so I went and did a master's, and I basically just had a couple of years of really, really grinding. I had to go, I was in London for my master's. I was just in a really cheap, crappy apartment. I had no money to spend the whole year. I was basically just, you know, working my ass off, and then got an internship after my master's, again, working my ass off. It was for PayPal. So it was quite potentially getting me onto a good path, but it was an internship where I wasn't getting paid a lot. A lot of people coming out of the master's were getting onto like 40K, you know, £40,000 going to consulting and whatnot. But I had a sense of what I wanted to do. I wanted to kind of work in sort of different sort of space. I wanted to work in more innovation, do something a bit. Yeah, I didn't fancy joining the old sorts of institutional world. And so I really worked hard, grinded for a long time with not a lot necessarily to show for it up in that point, right? Because I'm not getting paid a lot. I'm still an intern and whatnot. But eventually, by the time that ends, I basically find myself in a situation where, PayPal are desperate to, you know, very keen to keep me at least. I have another job offer from quite a well thought of startup. And then I have a third job offer, which is the one I eventually took from, basically it was in the Trinity Mirror, which is the parent company of the Mirror. So in their sort of innovation department, and a young Greek entrepreneur was launching a mental health platform. And I was just so, you know, I was going to be sort of the third or fourth person in the team, sort of first proper hire. And so it was just one of those, and, you know, it was everything from a career development. It was a great opportunity. And basically when the call came in and, you know, I got that offer, I sort of found myself with these three things on the table. And it was just one of those moments where my sort of hustling, right, was validated, right? Where, you know, it's not easy to just put your head down and keep grinding away when you're not getting tangible returns from it. But you have to sort of have a lot of faith in yourself and your plan that you're kind of actually, it's all going to amount to something, right? And that was one of those. And so whenever you do get one of those breakthrough moments where you validate yourself to your family, who might have thought, like, I'm not quite sure what he's doing makes sense. He could have taken a more of a traditional, easier path. And so that was, yeah, one of the, probably the first time in my life where I was like, okay, I've really achieved something now. Like I've really kind of pulled myself together, and it's extremely gratifying. So that was probably just one of the most satisfying feelings I've had when that all came together.
Yeah, it is good when that happens. I mean, sometimes I think I'm still waiting for my breakthrough moments. I mean, you've got things together probably earlier than I did. I did get, at the age of 20, I landed a good job with a big global market research firm and rose up within that company and thought I was doing pretty well during my 20s. But in hindsight, I wish I hadn't gone that route because I was completely unfulfilled. I was very much...
It slowed
much,
you down in pursuit of a broader fulfillment. Yeah.
I wasn't achieving anything artistic or worthwhile. It was just number crunching. You know, it paid the bills, but the longer it went on, the more I felt like I was selling my soul.
Yeah. And in hindsight, it didn't necessarily move you along the more important path that you wanted to go down.
Yeah, I sort of realized by the time I got into my 30s that pursuing money wasn't what I wanted to do. Mm. I still wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do something by myself.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've been doing bits and pieces of writing for years, but it's only, I mean, settling down in my late 30s, having the kids and starting to write the books. I mean, now I would say, my breakthrough moment is probably now because I'm making a living on my own back doing the thing I want to do.
Yeah.
I guess the real breakthrough, which I'm still waiting for, is the phone call from the big TV production company who are like, can we make spend £100 million turning your books into a set of movies or films? So I guess that's that. We all have ambition. I guess that's my number one at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I I'm very much in a new cycle of that as well. So I'm now doing something extremely different. And again, it started a new cycle and still waiting for certain breakthroughs in my new path. But obviously each one, you know, the first time it happens, it at least validates, and you've got to always be sense checking yourself and make sure that you're still honest, you're honest with yourself or whatnot. But you know, when it happens the first time, it's a important step. It's an important validation because you appreciate that, okay, when I actually do have a plan and I actually work to it and I really grind, that I can make things happen, right? That I can sort of create the future that I want for myself. It's not sort of, it was all smooth after that, because I'm now doing something very different and that has fed into what I'm doing. I've learned a lot from those experiences, but yeah, sort of, I find myself in a new cycle, and hopefully I'll have another validation moment, large validation moment in the near future.
Yeah. I mean, I think we are all potentially the architects of our own success.
Yeah.
And the harder you work at it and the more dedicated you are, the more likely you are to succeed.
Mm.
But on top of that, I guess maybe it's 80% hard work, but you do need that little slice of luck for the right thing to just happen. But like I say, the harder you work, the more chance it is. So if you throw 50 darts at the dartboard, you are more likely to hit the bullseye at some point.
Well, it's hard work. But the other thing I've appreciated more is it's easy to sort of hide behind a mindless slog.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to sort of say you're working hard, but you're not actually doing the hard thinking, because I don't think there's anything quite as, other than sort of extreme exercise or whatever, there's nothing harder to do than think hard.
Yeah.
And so it can be quite easy. You get into a rhythm and you just sort of hide behind that, and you convince yourself you might be working quite long hours and the rest of it. Yeah. But I think those real advances come from really, really throwing yourself at it, really kind of deeply thinking about it. And really trying to force your personality or force your will onto the world. And that takes something almost a bit deeper than hard work, right? And that's one of the things I've been appreciating lately, is that that need to be kind of constantly digging deep and trying to grind that next leap forward, right? Rather than just sort of slogging on a weekly basis.
Yeah. And one of the most important things I would add to that is that you've got to have the bravery to step out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
I was at Nielsen for 15 years, which in hindsight was probably at least 5 years too long, maybe even 10. I should have got out and gone and done something else, but it was convenient. You know, it was in Oxford. It was just down the road. I had a company car and I could have done more. But it doesn't matter. I mean, things have worked out now, but I certainly, it's strange that I've got more ambition and drive at 50 plus than I had 30 years ago.
That's very encouraging to hear. Yeah. Someone who's just entered his third decade. So
yeah,
there we go. Glad to hear that.
Okay. Okay, good. So
fourth decade, I should say. That's what the 30s are. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, we've talked about your 3 days, and now we move on to the bonus round, so to speak. This is where you get a chance to talk about a famous person from history or even the present who you might like to go and be for a day. So who would you choose?
Yeah, so I would choose Billy the Kid, and I would admit to not actually being too familiar with his story. He's very much someone that I chose because the being an outlaw in the Wild West, the Wild West in particular, is, I wasn't someone who grew up watching the Wild West films, but in recent years, it's something that has started to take on more of a significance for me, particularly in the last couple of years. And I actually happened to be in Texas when the whole pandemic hit off, just before we were going into the lockdowns. And so it was sort of quite symbolic that as things have changed so drastically, as our kind of the change we spoke about earlier really accelerated, I was sort of in the old Western frontier. And I think the reason why it sort of stands out in me a lot is it's the last time that the Western, the Anglo, you know, the Anglo man was truly free. You know, everything since then has been, you know, it's just become more, it's become more of a machine, right? You have, you know, industrial capitalism gradually evolved. And after the Second World War, it really changed into something different where you just have these big superstructures, right? You know, became the sort of technocratic world that we live in today, really sort of accelerated after World War II. But the process was, you know, well underway before that. And so everything is taken care of in our life, right? You know, we sort of sit at the end of very complex supply chains. We have police, you know, around us who can, you know, protect us from getting robbed and the rest of it. And, you know, we're utterly pampered. We're sort of in some sort of life support machine. And that was, you know, the Western America. And it always amazes me how long I always assumed it was sort of in the 18th century, you know, the 1700s, but even the late sort of 19th century, like Billy the Kid was around in the 1870s. And even then it was still really wild out there. There was still cowboys and Indian stuff was still going on. And so I just would want to experience that. I think it's something that, like I said, we're sort of we live in a very coddled world now. And it was the last time when at least the Western man, didn't have that, had a very different, much more raw experience. So that's why I'd like to go back and be Billy for the day.
Oh yeah. I mean, definitely. And I think, I mean, we often talk about nostalgia on this channel, and we talk about the 50s and the 60s. But when you look at the first, say, 50 years or so of Hollywood, the Western genre, I mean, practically every other movie was a Western. They made thousands of them. Yeah. And so you're talking about people making movies, say, in the 1930s or 1940s about things that only sort of happened within living memory then. Sort of Tombstone, I think, was 1888. And obviously people back then felt a certain nostalgia for that time. Certainly it's something I'd like to visit. I mean, I love the whole idea. I mean, there's the sort of lawlessness, and it would have been incredibly dangerous. I can't imagine life expectancy was high, but that whole, I know it's a movie cliche, but I love the whole idea of the saloon and you know, all those cliches. So there's the barman sliding the beer along the bar. There's, you go in and the guys are playing poker, and you go and play poker with them, and they'll either cheat you so you'll lose, or if you beat them, they'll beat you up and rob you anyway, so you can't win. And then you've got the local women of ill repute sort of on the balcony above the bar trying to tempt
waving
you upstairs.
Waving down
and in the big frilly dresses. And chances are, you know, you fall out with someone and you'll be outside having pistols at dawn, which I think, I don't know the exact way the law worked, but I think duels in that sense were legal, perhaps. I don't know or how it all worked, but and then you got the local sheriff and everything. It's just, it's a fascinating time. And it would be nice to go there for a day and try and survive it.
Yeah, like you said, a day, right? It's quite helpful that the question is framed as a day because, yeah, like you said, the life expectancy, I'm sure, wouldn't be particularly high, and it might be pretty terrifying being there. I'm sure there was plenty of stuff that would make the modern person squeamish.
Yes.
So a day to experience it and really soak that up would probably be a good dose, a healthy enough dose for you to take with you for quite a while.
Excellent. Okay, well, just to finish off, is there anywhere else in history you'd like to go?
Yeah, so the second sort of time and place that I've been thinking about a lot recently is medieval England. And there's a couple of reasons for this. I mean, a lot of this is brought, I will admit, a lot of this is sort of caught up in the things I think about when I'm trying to analyze the political situation. So this is why I kind of think about this. And obviously feudal England came before the nation state, and it's sort of the last different form of political organization that we've had. So as we move to something new, it's always, you know, I think it'd be very enriching and fascinating to go back and sort of walk around and understand how deeply things worked in the past. So that's sort of one dimension, you know, where you're looking at sort of how identity worked. I think a lot of the issues in the modern world, a lot of the political confusions and and sort of falling outs are very much about people's identity. I think we're all sort of quite alienated, and that works itself on different dimensions, whether sort of individual identity. And this is where you're getting a lot more of the sort of crazier sides of the liberal stuff that's been going on, but also the sort of Brexit Trump debates. That's also about sort of national versus international identity. And so I think that going back to medieval England and understanding this sort of sense of identity that the peasant might have had for and how he felt attached to his land, and the sort of sense of the bond that he had with his lord, and how that interfaced with the bond he might have had to the church, I think it would be extremely, extremely enriching. And that's the first part. But the second part is also that this sort of came before the Enlightenment, right? So the Enlightenment really changed the way that we perceive the world in terms of this obsession with science, this obsession with measuring everything, this really heavy rationalistic worldview, which I think underpins pretty much everything that we're seeing today. It's sort of, we're trying to, everything is just fitting into a spreadsheet, right? Everything is needs to be measured and managed and the rest of it. And so to kind of go back and chat to people and experience people who are inhabiting an utterly different sort of form of consciousness almost would be amazing, would be incredible. So that's why I chose that.
Yeah. Well, everybody knew what their place was, didn't they? But I guess it depends when you were there, because in relatively peaceful and prosperous times, it would have been quite pleasant. But I would imagine when various wars come along, the peasants are sort of the first ones to be the cannon fodder.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, and I mean, there would have been, I'm trying to think what would have been the most dangerous place to be, either the Wild West or medieval England during the sort of various civil wars, Hundred Years War and Black Death and everything else. But again, you probably want to visit for a day.
And see. Yeah, visit for a small amount of time. And again, just have a long afternoon in whatever the contemporary equivalent of a bar was, and just chat to the punters, I think.
Yeah, the local tavern.
Pretty fascinating.
The local tavern. Yeah, and that's a good point, because when we hear about history and they make documentaries about history, all it ever seems to be is about the kings and queens and that side of things. And I'm fascinated by social history. I'd like to go and sit in, you know, some peasant's hovel and see what they did in the evening. Far more interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you'd have some assuming you could find some common grounds for conversation.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you'd have pretty hilarious and very, very informative and enriching. Yeah.
I think they'd be very much like us. Anyway, we're almost out of time, so I'll just have to thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed going a little journey through time and space.
I'll put a link to your podcast in the description, and that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brilliant. Thanks, Jason.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.